4%. That's the total greenhouse gas emission burden. It's hardly a burden for 52 countries. The global military come in at 5.5%. So to look to NATO, to come to NATO, which, as I say, is a 31-member military alliance, accounts for half of military spending. In terms of emissions, it currently would rank, if it were a country, NATO would come in at 40, the equivalent of the Netherlands, for example. And with this 2% of GDP request, what NATO are asking the 31 members to do is to increase on what they're spending now and get their military spending, annual military spending, up to 2% or more of GDP. Okay, so what we worked on, we asked the question, well, what would that mean for greenhouse gas emissions? And what would it mean for military spending? And we worked over this eight-year period of 2021 to 2028. And in the case of military spending, it would be over that eight-year period accruing another $2.57 trillion over that eight-year period. And that $2.57 trillion would get you, as an example, 118 years of that paltry $100 billion climate finance figure that was agreed at in the Paris meeting in 2015.
And what do you mean by climate finance?
So this is the $100 billion that was agreed in 2015 at Paris.
Hillary Clinton announced in Paris.
As support, climate finance support for the world's most vulnerable countries. And we, the rich countries, are legally bound to deliver that. So what we're trying to do with the scale of military spending, which is in the trillions, is to put that alongside these, on the one hand, pledges, and on the other hand, gaps. There are so many climate finance gaps. The 2% GDP target for NATO members in terms of emissions, so there is an emissions burden to this. Currently, NATO is sitting, again, you know, it's something in the order of, you know, in the order of the Netherlands, emissions, in terms of emissions. That 2% increase over that eight-year period, again, we calculate would bring it closer to Russia, Russia's emissions burden. Russia is a major, you know, oil-producing country. It's something like 2 billion tons of CO2 equivalent.
In fact, actually, President Putin is expected to be here in Dubai tomorrow.
What can we say? I mean, you know, it's clear here at COP, and certainly in terms of this issue that we're working on here, the military emissions story, and it's primarily because of Ukraine and now with Gaza, suddenly we are able to get some oxygen of publicity. You know, we're here now talking about this because of this collision between conflict, wars, conflict-related emissions, which I should say is not in that 5.5% estimate. This estimate of 5.5% of global military greenhouse gas emissions accruing to the military does not include conflict. Doesn't include conflict. So with Ukraine and now Gaza, we are able to illustrate, to show, to as I say, bring oxygen and publicity to the fact that there is an absolute correlation between military spending. So the more you spend on your big ticket, gas-guzzling, fossil fuel, totally fossil fuel-reliant hardware, the jets, the tanks, the bombs, the missiles, all of these things that we are seeing raining down on people, they are all fossil fuel-dependent. There is an absolute correlation between military spending and the emissions that come from that hardware. And we are going in the wrong direction. We are absolutely going in the wrong direction. And the NATO 2% target, for example, is completely counter to all climate targets.
So what do you mean by 2% target?
Of GDP. So NATO
must spend on the military.
They are asking their 31 members to spend 2%.
Remember Trump, President Trump kept saying, are not paying
in
your
fact,
fair
more,
share.
And more we need you to spend more. And it doesn't really stop at NATO. NATO have allies in other parts of the world who are looking at 2% or more. So this 2% of GDP, it's important, it doesn't sound like very much, but it's very significant because you're talking about orders of billions over a period of time.
I want to turn to Shireen El Jurdi. We just came in on Saturday night. Sunday, there was a major protest against what's happening in Gaza, calling for a ceasefire. There were at least 100 people protesting, holding a sign that said ceasefire. You were one of the people there. The names of the dead were being intoned throughout the protests. You just heard our last segment talking about what's happening in Gaza. You're with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Can you talk about the connection between war, weapons, and militarism, directly what's happening in Gaza?
Yeah, we can see like the gloomy picture just like by what we saw now and by Deborah, the numbers that she gave. This is a gloomy picture that we have, and definitely what we see and what we know is that women are disproportionately impacted by conflict. So what about if you have lack of infrastructures? Especially when we talk about conflict, it means we're talking about lack of infrastructures of peace, of institutions, and also lack of the rule of law. And unfortunately, this is all unfolding in Gaza and the Middle East at large, in other conflict areas as well. But maybe now we're talking about Palestine per se and what's happening in Gaza. What's happening is tremendous. I mean, I could not even believe that we're living this at this moment in our history. This is too hard even to believe that we're witnessing that. We're witnessing that within our own eyes. And I think it's just obvious, like the impact of militarization on women. And we've seen it in different spaces. We've seen it, like as now was mentioned, like in hospitals. We've seen it with mothers. We've seen it like at the grassroots.
How many women were pregnant in Gaza?
Almost 50,000 women were pregnant at that time. And if we have seen with the lack of electricity, when electricity was put down, we saw even these infants struggling to breathe, to continue living. And unfortunately, lots of these newly born kids were also killed. And this is not only a genocide, I mean, this is goes beyond humanity. So the nexus between climate, militarization, gender is highly now needed, especially now that we are in the COP, especially that the issue of militarization is not put on the agenda. And at times, like we see that the circle, if we really want to talk about emissions, if we really want to talk about fossil fuel phase out, if we really want to talk about GST, if we want to talk about real impacts and outputs out of this COP, we really need to look at militarization. We need to look at it from first the resources, the production, the export, the import, and how it is being used. Like now in Gaza and also in Lebanon, the white phosphorus bombs. I don't know if you noticed or if you saw in TikTok, it went viral, how they're telling people how to remove the white phosphorus bombs. We're used
to the white phosphorus from their skin.
Yeah, from their skin, because it will keep on going into your skin. And what about the implications that it has on the soil? What about the implications that it has on the water, on the earth that we are having and breathing as well?
I want to read you something from Al Jazeera. From polluted water supplies to toxic smoke-filled air, from burning buildings and bodies, every aspect of life in Gaza is now filled with some form of pollution. There's evidence of Israel using white phosphorus weapons both in Gaza and South Lebanon. This has disastrous effects on both the environment and people's health. You're focusing on Palestine. You yourself are from Lebanon.
Yeah. Amy, it's in Palestine, we saw it with our own eyes. And we saw because of the many journalists that they're risking their lives and many who lost their lives as well, risking to take photos and to document the atrocities that are being done. In Lebanon as well, we have seen also have how phosphorus weapons were used, and we saw also how this huge area, green areas of olive trees were burned and put down, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon. I mean, it's a huge catastrophe, whether at the forest level, whether at the human level, and it's going beyond issues of actual present and direct impact to the trauma that everyone is living.
And this is from Euromed Human Rights Monitor. Due to technological developments affecting the potency of bombs, the explosives dropped on Gaza may be twice as powerful as a nuclear bomb.
Exactly. That was even like 2 weeks ago before the ceasefire. So I could see, like, now I was even scared to see because, I mean, it's too, yeah. you cannot even watch these bombs that are being. Yesterday I was watching, I follow several journalists, and I was watching her, and she was saying, now this is a massacre. If these, like, now bombs are being used while we are called to go to the south to a safe space, but there's no safe space. So this is meant to terminate us.
Deborah. You absolutely can't talk about this without the arms industry.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they're all, you know, when we talk about even emissions, the arms industry, the supply chain for militaries are more polluting than the militaries themselves, which may come as a bit of a surprise. But they are like this. The arms industry, just in the way that you can track oil through and military, the military's use of oil through war, of course, when they're in, you know, at war, oil usage goes up. So you can track profits, war profits, to the arms industry. There is no story without fully addressing the culpability of the arms trade. And I've brought something I want to read because it will apply to Gaza. It absolutely will apply to Gaza. Their stock shares, are going up as soon as any conflict hits. They're making profits as it is. It's a very nice life, thank you very much, as it is. When conflict kicks in, it's off the scale. So this is the CEO of Raytheon. Okay, and I want to read this.
Yeah.
Everything that's being shipped into Ukraine today, of course, is coming out of stockpiles, either at the DOD, the Department of Defense, or from our NATO allies, and that's all great news. Eventually, we'll have to replenish it, and we will see the benefit to the business over the coming years. That's a guy called Greg Hayes, CEO of Raytheon. Israel's suppliers, everybody that's involved in the food chain, the kind of war machine food chain that is enabling Israel to do what it is doing on Gaza, will be making money. They will be going home very happy with their bottom lines and their profits in their back pockets.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And we will link to your report. Deborah Burton is the co-founder of Tipping Point North South. She leads their Transform Defense project, focused on military emissions and spending, making the link between climate change and militarism. And Shireen El-Jurdi, women, peace, and security expert from Lebanon. Thanks so much, both, for being
Thank
with us.
Thank you for having us.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the record number of fossil fuel lobbyists here at the UN Climate Summit in Dubai. Stay with us. People go. Max Roach with the J.C. White Singers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from COP28, the UN Climate Summit, here in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, where a record 2,500 lobbyists are registered to attend this year, nearly four times as many as last year. They're from companies like Shell, Total, and ExxonMobil. They outnumber the delegations of every country except Brazil, which is set to host the summit in 2025, and this year's host, the United Arab Emirates delegation. The summit's presided over by the CEO of the UAE's national oil company, Sultan Al Jaber, who has said there's no science behind demands for the phase-out of fossil fuels to address the climate crisis. Earlier this week, activists addressed the massive number of lobbyists at the COP during a side event. This is Eric Nijuguma from Kenya with Fridays for Future, MAPA. Brenna Two Bears with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Drew Slatter, a Pacific Climate Warrior from Fiji. But first, David Tong with Oil Change International.
You wouldn't invite arms dealers to a peace conference. And the oil lobbyists here at the climate conference must not stop this conference from succeeding in delivering a phase out of fossil fuels.
The presence of the fossil fuel industry at its climate negotiations shows the moral bankruptcy of the fossil fuel industry.
Fossil fuel lobbyists should not be here. They weave a web of greed and sacrifice zones like the Dakota Access Pipeline. They have received over $3 billion from Bank of America, which is the same bank that's also interested in the Energy Transition Accelerator, an ambitious initiative that was announced by the U.S. Climate Envoy a few days ago. We will not stand by while these false solutions are heralded as the solution to the climate crisis. There is only one solution to the climate crisis. Decolonization and an indigenous just transition away from systems of extraction.
Before this press conference, I was speaking briefly with a few other Pacific Climate Warriors about the sheer number of fossil fuel lobbyists present here. And a well-known Pacific Climate Warrior, Brianna Fruin, spoke to us about it, and she said it's because they're scared. There's more of them here because they know that the age of fossil fuels is coming to an end. It must come to an end. The people have spoken. The science has spoken. All that's left is to ensure that these processes no longer allow them in the room so that our negotiators, our leaders, can take the necessary steps to keep us below 1.5 degrees of heating.
That last voice you just heard was Drew Slatter, Pacific Climate Warrior from Fiji. For more, we're joined by Rachel Rose Jackson. She moderated that event here at the UN Climate Summit. She's Director of Climate Research and Policy at Corporate Accountability, part of the Kick Big Polluters Out coalition that just released their report, Record Number of Fossil Fuel Lobbyists at COP28. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we've just been talking about Gaza and what's happening there. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the Israeli bombardment of Gaza at this point. Nearly 16,000 people are dead. The connection, if you will, between that and lobbyists here at the UN Climate Summit.
So when it comes to the systemic injustices in the world, we can't look at these things in a vacuum. We have to zoom out and look at them globally. And when we do that, we can see very clearly that the same geopolitical powers, political elite, and even abusive corporations who are responsible for burning fossil fuels, delaying action, and fueling the climate crisis on one hand, are the same political elite and abusive corporations who are responsible for standing by and even enabling the genocide that's playing out in Gaza. And when it comes to genocide, there isn't a side. There's only the 16,000 and counting lives that have been lost without any justification. And it's the same thing with the climate crisis. there is no justification for the millions of lives that have already been lost and impacted simply because of the greed of polluters and global north governments who have enabled this crisis to happen. So these systemic injustices, they don't happen in a vacuum, and they also have the same source. That also means they have the same solutions. And there is, you know, no climate justice without human rights. And there's also no climate justice on occupied land. So everything that we're seeing here is so relevant to everything that's playing out in Gaza and in other places where genocide is happening around the world. It's the same problem, and we need to hold the same people to account.
You know, Rachel, when we asked people about the lobbyists who are here, everyone said you have to talk to Rachel Rose Jackson. So talk about this report that you came out with, how you figured out that there were thousands of lobbyists here. It was very interesting to hear David Tong when asked about lobbyists. Why can't they be here like anyone else? And he said, if you were holding a peace conference, would you invite arms manufacturers to it?
I mean, it's exactly that. And I don't think it's just me. You know, this whole coalition, Kick Big Polluters Out, we're 450 organizations and networks around the world representing millions of people who are all united in challenging what's happening here in these halls and demanding an end of fossil fuel lobbyists and big polluters to write the rules of climate action. It's the same thing that, you know, as David Tong said, if your house is burning down, if it's on fire, do you hand the hose to the arsonist? No, but that's exactly what's happening here.
So the number of lobbyists, nearly 2,500, we said at the beginning, it's equal, it's larger than any delegation here except the host now, UAE, they have something like 3,000, and the host gonna be in 2 years, Brazil.
Exactly. And not only that, but there's a record-breaking number of fossil fuel lobbyists who are here at this talk. Last year in Sharm el-Sheikh, there were around 630 known fossil fuel lobbyists. The year before that, 500. So this year, there's a 4 times increase in the number of fossil fuel lobbyists here promoting a deadly fossil fuel agenda.
Do you think it's related to who is president of the COP of the UN Climate Summit, the Sultan Al-Jaber?
It's definitely
who is head of the, one of the largest oil companies in the world, ADNOC, the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company.
It's definitely impossible to ignore how front and center the fossil fuel influence is at this particular COP. I mean, as you just said, it travels all the way up to the highest levels. But this problem is as old as these climate talks are. You know, from the very inception, there have been no measures to protect these talks from fossil fuel industry influence.
How do fossil fuel lobbyists affect the talks? Where are they allowed in? Where aren't they?
They're allowed everywhere. They're allowed right behind us where we are. But more than that, they're allowed even in places where civil society doesn't have access to. These fossil fuel lobbyists are often given country delegation badges. So these pink badges you might see some people wearing, and that gets them into rooms that I and even you could never get into. It gives them direct access to the literal ears of the decision makers who are writing the rules of climate action. It gives them a seat at the head of the table, and it doesn't even stop there. They're also literally bankrolling these climate talks. They're paying for these talks to happen. They're signing the checks. They're signing the dotted line of the outcomes that come out of these talks. So their fingerprints are all over what's happening here.
I want to turn to Brenna Tubear. You had this side panel this week that was really interesting. Brenna is Diné, Brenna Tubears from the United States. She's with the Indigenous Environmental Network.
We are here today to address the climate crisis. So why was there twice as many fossil fuel lobbyists at COP26 than Indigenous delegates? Why are we as Indigenous people only allowed to have an observer status, but fossil fuel lobbyists are allowed to have direct access to parties? The more lobbyists that are here, the higher our emissions rise. And in a report released by the Center for Biological Diversity last month, the Biden administration has approved 17 massive fossil fuel projects, estimated to release the same amount of emissions as 440 coal-fired power plants. The reason why this is so important is because for those of us who grew up on the Navajo Rez, for those of us
who didn't have paved roads in our homes, who didn't have running water or access to electricity. But we had these coal-fired power plants in our backyard. That number is preposterous. It's awful, and it breaks our hearts. I used to haul water to my grandfather's house. That same clean access to drinkable water would have been available to him if it hadn't been taken from the Navajo Aquifer, which is one of the most pristine sources of groundwater in the world, and transported to the Black Mesa coal mine in order to slurry coal to the Navajo generating station. Not only was it wasting so much water, about 4,400 feet of groundwater a year since 1971, but it wasn't going to any of the communities that were on the Navajo reservation. Thankfully, because of the grassroots movement from the Hopi and the Diné, who are out there in Arizona and the southwest area of the United States, we were able to shut down the Black Mesa coal mine in 2019. And we were able to stop the use of that Navajo generating station, being able to slurry that coal in 2001.
That's Brenna Two-Bears with the Indigenous Environmental Network, and this is Pacific Climate Warrior Drew Slatter speaking at the side event here at the UN COP Summit on Monday.
We need to remove fossil fuel lobbyists from climate negotiations if the Pacific is to have a shot at survival. And that shot, it is possible. It often feels like it's not, but it is possible. We can achieve a phase-out of fossil fuels. We can achieve 100% renewable energy. We can achieve a fair and efficient finance package for the energy transition in the Pacific. But the obscene number of big polluters at these climate negotiations threatens that. In Glasgow, fossil fuel lobbyists outnumbered Pacific delegates 12 to 1. If I'm not wrong, last year the number rose to 15 to 1. And the number this year is expected to be even higher.
Drew Slatter, Pacific Climate Warrior from Fiji. Our guest is Rachel Rose Jackson, who pulled everyone together to talk about the detrimental effect of the lobbyists here at the UN Climate Summit. In fact, right behind me, you may hear the noise getting higher and higher. People are lining up because Sultan Al-Jaber is just about to hold a news conference, or at least to speak, Rachel.
Yeah, he is. And, you know, as I alluded to earlier, it's for sure fair to say that the fossil fuel influence could not be more obvious at these talks. But we have to remember that these talks have been co-opted to serve the fossil fuel agenda since they began. There have been no measures since day one to protect these talks to ensure that they deliver the action that people and the planet deserve. You know, whether the COP is in Poland, the coal capital of the world, or the United States, the world's largest historical emitter of fossil fuels, and, I might add, the world's largest obstructor at these talks from a government perspective, these COPs are infested with fossil fuel influence.
You're a specialist on pushing tobacco on the world, and now you're talking about climate. What is the model that was used? We just have about 30 seconds.
It's important to understand that the UN climate talks are the exception, not the norm. Other UN bodies, institutions around the world, they all begin with making sure that there is insulation from keeping the source of the problem out of solving the problem. That's happened with the UN Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, as you mentioned, but it has never happened here. So now we are so far into the process, we are running out of time. We must kick big polluters out. We must end their ability to write the rules of climate action. We must end their ability to bankroll these climate talks and reset the system so that it can finally end fossil fuels and advance real solutions and save millions of lives that don't need to be lost.
Well, Rachel Rose Jackson, we thank you so much for being with us. Director of Climate Research and Policy at Corporate Accountability and the Kick Big Polluters Out Coalition released their report, Record Number of Fossil Fuel Lobbyists at COP28. We'll link to your report. A special happy birthday to Igor Marino. I'm Amy Goodman.
Democracy Now! hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to Your Daily Progressive News, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.